Hello and welcome to another edition of Freight Club, a WTA Group podcast. Today, we're discussing export advice and market opportunities in the food and drink industry with Tony Goodman. Tony has been involved in exporting for over 30 years, experiencing great success with his 10-acre snacks brand and several others. These days, he's an export champion for the Department of Business and Trade, advising firms of all sizes how to maximise exporting success in food and drink. The perfect man then to provide some insights for business leaders. Well, thanks very much for joining me on the podcast today, Tony. It's really great to have you joining me.
Good to be here.
So we'll go from the very top with a question that you'll probably be very familiar with. Why is it important then that businesses export?
If you're manufacturing, and it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's food or chemicals or any industrial product, once you finish saturating your home market, you've got this natural evolution that you need to start looking for new markets if you want to continue to expand. And normally, businesses in their home market cover all their overhead. So they've got a factory, they've got production lines, and they may well have spare capacity. They might need to take on some more people to do that, but you know, they could have spare capacity. And if they've got spare capacity, then actually there is a marginal improvement in exporting, because they don't have to have all those overheads again. They've already got a lot of those overheads. There might be some new, but they don't have all the fundamental startup costs. So actually, it can be more profitable exporting than it can be when you first start off developing in your home market. Now, I mentioned the word markets rather than countries, because people often confuse this. When we sell to people. And those people form a market. They aren't forming just a country group. Because in this country, if you look at the way it works, there are all sorts of markets. You know, if you've got a luxury product, that's a narrow market. If you've got a pound product, that's a very different market. If you've got a middle of the range product, you know, and so on. So what you need to do always is look for those markets that exist. And they might exist, for instance, in various parts of a country. So if you take the biggest extreme example in this is obviously China. China is an enormous country, you know, 1.4 billion people, over 20 times the size of the UK. And there you've got these major city regions, five major city regions that are all bigger than the UK. So within those, there can be a distinct market for a product that can be bigger than that equivalent market in the UK. But we're still talking about markets that you look for, and this is how you find those markets that you want to export to. The markets are within countries, so you're exporting to markets rather than just to countries.
So given that explanation, what sort of objections are you hearing then to finding new markets at events, or do you find once you've said that to people, they tend not to object?
I think the objection comes about more through fear or concern, and it's fear or concern of the unknown. They start thinking, well, if I'm going to export, how do I deal with China? Well, okay, in the start of your exporting journey, don't deal with China. Deal with Ireland, deal with France, deal with the Netherlands. There are distributors in every country around the world. And if you connect with them, they will assist you and work with you in developing those marketplaces. So the real problem is fear of the unknown. And that word export seems like to a lot of people like a barrier. So I've taken to calling it international selling, international trade. It's really this psychological hang-up over the word export that people get concerned about. In my finding, they think that this is something completely different, where everything is going to change for them. And there are changes, of course, but there are changes you have with every new customer that you gain in a business.
Yeah. Do you think then, as you kind of hinted at there, a big part of this being successful is just doing it in stages?
It depends on the size of business you are and the resources you've got. So if, for instance, you are a company I was reading about that's doing very well in the export market at the moment. A small company called Rolls-Royce, selling aero engines.
Yes, I think I've heard of those.
Yeah, they've just announced some new deal, which is great. Great news for this country. You've got all the resources in the world to sell into a new market to experiment, and just it's just another add-on. As for a smaller company, it would be just another add-on to sell in this country. When you sell in this country, you don't suddenly say, ah, right, I'm from Manchester, but we've decided we're going to sell to the southeast. That's not the way business works. You sell customer by customer. Mm. Or you tie in with a distributor who becomes your customer. So you're doing it distributor by distributor. So in the first place, depending on what it is, because, of course, these days an awful lot of products can be sold online. One of our wonderful export champions in the Lake District had a deli, and they decided to create a website for some of their pickles and jams. And lo and behold, people started buying them from overseas. Now they're a big exporter simply because they'd started a website. But having said that, there are also a lot of organizations in this country that buy on behalf of foreign companies. So, for instance, the Gulf is a great market for UK food and drink. And one of the major supermarkets in the Gulf is called Lulu. And they have a buying office in Birmingham. So, you know, if you want to export to them, yes, you've got to go to Birmingham, or you've got to talk to them. But that, you know, if you ship it, you're shipping it to Birmingham. You're not actually involved in any of those other things. And whilst you were involved in the export market, you've actually got a UK sale. Now, that sort of thing goes on. But there are also a lot of bigger distributors who work across a range of companies who are always looking for new products. And a lot of overseas businesses have buying offices. So, for instance, the company that's known in this country is TK Maxx. They're actually an American company, but they've got a buying office in Watford. They actually go, you know, they'll take a meeting room in a hotel around the country to go and meet people because they're constantly looking for new suppliers. And it isn't just for clothing that you might think, it's also for household goods, for food. So when I was in the snacks business with 10 Acre, we were selling them container loads of products that they were shipping to America, they were shipping to Canada, and we sold it Ex Works. Now, again, this is something people worry about. Well, how will I know if I get paid? How will I know if to do all the paperwork? Well, one of the things, we were a small company. If we couldn't get credit insurance on people, we would sell Ex Works, which means that we got paid before the goods left the door, and they would come and collect them. There are a lot of ways of shipping it. And one of the things I should add, and please don't anyone feel that I've been asked to say this, but one of your best friends can be your freight company, your freight forwarders, because they do this for a living. And if you get the right relationship with a freight forwarder, they are going to help your export journey, because they will help you overcome a lot of those barriers.
Yes, it's very kind of you to say that.
Genuinely.
Yeah, that's certainly something that we talk about a lot, is making it more than just a transactional relationship, and really building up a bit of a rapport with them, and using us or other freight forwarders for guidance is a helpful tool for any exporter. I was going to ask about the different ways in which, you know, you can perhaps export, but you've touched on a lot of them there. But one question I do have is if you perhaps maybe looking for a local distributor in the market that you're targeting, how effective can that be as a strategy for exporting?
It can be very effective. So, for instance, one of our best export markets for British food, and we are talking about crisps and popcorn and chocolate, but one of our best markets was actually France, which might surprise you. We sold an awful lot of product into France. And when I was looking for a distributor, the criteria I would use was, number one, did they already buy things from the UK? Now, that's important, because actually the company I went with had a consolidator in the UK. So we could deliver to their consolidator in the UK, and they would fill up lorries to go over to France with a range of products, which means that they didn't have to begin the relationship, didn't have to buy in such big bulk. That made life a lot simpler for both of us, because they had, you know, a weekly shipment going to France. Everyone knew the schedule. We would deliver it and it would be there as quickly and as easily as possible. Number two, I look, well, are they selling into the right marketplace? We had premium crisps and popcorn. Were they selling into premium locations? Did they have other products that would go well alongside ours? So in other words, did they already have connections with the right buyers in the right organizations? Number three, I also wanted someone that wasn't selling one of our competitors' products, because then they have a dilemma as to which one they would be selling. Now, I found a very good distributor in France that met all of those criteria. We had a great relationship and business took off quickly because they had a sales team around the country, as we had in the UK, that were going out and just had extra products that they pushed into their existing customer base, as well as finding new customers. That distributor model can work very, very well. Another model that you can use is you find an agent to sell on your behalf. There are other complications and advantages. You should look at those very carefully and depending on the market you're in. And then, you know, for companies that are doing sufficient and have sufficient funds to invest, you can always look to open an office in a country. So all of those methods can work and can work well at different stages of your business.
So I just want to ask about market research. So what sort of tools are available for, first of all, researching a new market to perhaps explore, but then also to find these distributors and agents that you've just referred to there at perhaps later stages of your development into a new market?
My best friend was Professor Google. Now, that might sound trivial to you, but actually it's a great starting point, because if an organization doesn't have a website, you wouldn't want to be dealing with them anyway. And if they aren't optimizing the website in a way that you can find them, you wouldn't want to be dealing with them. So it's a great way of qualifying. And the other thing is, of course, you know, Google has translate facilities. So there's no website in the world, you know, pretty much that you can't understand and see whichever country, whichever language they're using. So that's a great starting point. Then, if they are an existing distributor, if it's a distributor that you're looking for instance, they will always be looking for more business. So they will be open to talking to people. There might not be a relationship. You can simply start by having a conversation online, by phone, and talking to people to understand each other. You can send them some samples so that they can understand what you're doing, and you can develop the relationship from that. So that's one very, very simple way that you can literally find a distributor in any other part of the world. Another way, which we use extensively, is some of the big international trade shows. So virtually any industry you're in, there is a trade show somewhere. Some of those big international trade shows are in the UK, where people come from all over the world to look at this international market. There are others in Europe, in the food industry, there's plenty. There's a huge one in Cologne every other year, and the in-between years, one in Paris. You get big food shows in the Gulf where people come from literally all over the world. And we found distributors that way. You don't have to pay to be an exhibitor. You can just go and walk the floor and explore. But if you do exhibit, you can, for instance, use the facilities of the DBT and go on the British Pavilion. So British products are very popular overseas because we have a reputation for quality, for design, in food, for good taste and certainly good quality. Being in the British Pavilion means that you've got a lot of support around you. Occasionally there can be some subsidies, and it makes it easier for people who are looking for British products to find you. Because some of these exhibitions are gigantic. So those are very easy ways. Then another way is to talk to the trade advisors from the DBT. So the trade advisors are a window into all the facilities that the DBT provide. There's a lot of online help, but also the DBT have people in country in most of the major markets that Britain sells to. So through the trade advisor, you can make contact with the people in market who can give you local advice and help. Now, some of the things are, like the OMIS reports and so on, are chargeable events. You can decide whether or not Google is sufficient for you or you want one of those, but you can also use in market just to ask some questions for some general information. And sometimes they will know people. You know, some of the people working for the DBT have worked in specific sectors in market for a long time and know the players in those markets as well as you might know the same players in your home market. And then there are other things that you can do as well, apart from things like some of the paid reports. One of the things we did in several countries was through the DBT, we arranged that our products would be used in the local embassy. Now, we might then go along, and in some of those, we could invite people to a particular embassy event. It might be a general reception with a few hundred people, but it's amazing how much people are keen to come and talk to you when you're in the British embassy somewhere, rather than just, you know, you're some random person who wants to have a meeting to sell them something. And this worked incredibly well. I mean, I think I did three at the British Embassy in Berlin in three different years. And that helped us get our distributors and some direct customers who we invited to events there. And at the same time, we provided some of our products to be used at those receptions. So everyone was tasting them. Same thing happened in Barcelona and Madrid and some others as well. Now, that isn't, you know, you need to build up a relationship and work with your trade advisor closely, and it's not just an immediate thing, but you can rent, for instance, the meeting room if you want a separate meeting place in a particular country. If you're going to a country and you want to meet a lot of people, you can look to use those things. There are many, many ways, and your trade advisor is a window into all of those. And of course, the export academies will teach you a lot about this. People like me with direct experience do talk at these and give hopefully practical advice, as well as getting the technical advice from a lot of the DBT experts. And they have great experts. So, you know, I've had meetings talking directly to the people who are negotiating trade agreements, for instance, in particular countries, because they want to understand what industry actually needs from those trade agreements, what's important, where the problems are, where the bottlenecks are, and so on. So there is feedback loops, you'll be pleased to know, but from a simple point of view, that trade advisor that you get from the DBT costs you nothing. They don't charge for their advice. You literally have nothing to lose by talking to them.
Yeah. Does feel like an open goal, that one. You just mentioned trade deals at the end of that answer. I'd just like to explore that a little bit more, because, you know, the UK has been signing quite a few trade deals with Australia and New Zealand. There's also an Asia-Pacific trading bloc called the CPTPP. The UK is going to join. You know, there's negotiations ongoing with India, South Korea, Mexico, and a few others. Do you advise businesses kind of look at these as potential new market opportunities? How do they factor into your thinking when you're advising people on exploring new markets?
I think, by the way, South Korea, we already have a trade agreement. We're just trying to enhance that trade agreement. And the same with Japan, for instance, which are two very good markets for us. South Korea is a great market for British companies, and Japan is just a great market. Generally, I think the trade agreements are symptomatic of where countries are open to trading with us as much as anything. And there are a lot of trade agreements. We're now signing up a form of trade agreement, trade understandings with individual states within the US as well. Trade agreements generally tend to be for bigger companies. Where the trade agreement really helps is on price, because of the elimination of tariffs. And there are some very peculiar things. So to give an example that I'm aware of, I have a friend who imports household textiles from India. There are tariffs at the moment on that trade of about 9% or 9 point something percent, I think. But the equivalents from Pakistan and Bangladesh, there are no tariffs because the British government, for various reasons, has reduced the tariffs on those as part of our cooperation with those countries. So the Indian company is at a great disadvantage. The trade agreement would mean that they would no longer be at that disadvantage. Mm. And actually, that would be to the advantage of UK consumers, because what it will actually mean is that prices will come down. At the moment, what it actually means is that Pakistani and Bangladesh companies have a price advantage that they're profiting from, which is fine because that's the rules. But because the rest of the world is paying tariffs, they're actually making more profits. The reduction in the tariffs with India being such a big market would actually increase their market share, but will tend to reduce prices, which is a great thing for the consumers here. And that works very much in reverse with trade agreements, so that if we're selling to a market where they already have trade agreements with other countries that we might compete with, we're at a competitive disadvantage. The trade agreement will mean that those tariffs are removed and we can play more on a level playing field, or even in a lot of cases, that we have a competitive advantage over our competitors. So for instance, the Asian group that you referred to, with a lot of those countries, they don't have a trade agreement with the EU. So we will actually have a competitive advantage over the EU in selling to them. If you like, it's a Brexit benefit that people don't talk about. And a lot of the things with these agreements are, well, how much are they actually worth? Well, the figures I saw yesterday showed that are in real terms, inflation adjusted and everything else, exports have grown in the last year again by, I think, 1.4% in real terms, which is fantastic achievement when a lot of our major markets, like in Europe, are in recession. So actually, British exports are doing very well, and they've grown massively over the last 5 years or so.
Just before we finish, then, I know that, you know, food and drink is a real area of real expertise for yourself, an industry that you've been in for a long time and know a lot about. So I just wanted to get a bit of insight, really, on where you see some exciting sort of food and drink market opportunities abroad.
Well, there are so many, and the food and drink market is a huge, broad market. So it very much depends which part of it you're on. And you can segment it vertically and you can segment it horizontally. You know, so you could say, well, we're selling whiskey. Well, you know, there are a lot of markets that are Muslim markets, for instance, are not great markets for selling whiskey into, although there is some marketplace in a lot of them. However, the Far East is a fantastic market at the moment for whiskey. Nowadays, of course, we've got a lot of Welsh and English whiskies as well coming up, some of which I've been fortunate to try. And they're very good. So, you know, you're in that. And then there was what we were doing, which was in crisp, popcorn, chocolate. The markets are completely and utterly different. And then segmenting them horizontally, are you in premium products? Are you in economy products? You know, are you in fresh food? Are you in frozen food? The markets in each of those is substantially different. But most foodstuffs, there's a market in a country somewhere. If you've got long shelf lives, the Far East is a massive growing market. I remember looking at some numbers from 10 years ago where it was reckoned that 5% of the Chinese market was what was termed as middle or higher income. Now, all that meant was they had some disposable income. Brands became extremely popular in China. However, with some political changes there, the very brazen branding of driving a Ferrari or having clothes with Armani on it or whatever have become less popular. And the discreet brands, which includes, of course, food and drink, because you're having those at home, have become far more popular. They still want quality. They just don't want to be so brazen about it. So 5% of the Chinese market has free discretionary spending, and that is bigger than the population of the UK. So the equivalent market in the UK might be 20%, 10, 20% of the UK market. It's a fraction of what it is in China. So if you're selling quality products into China, actually, you've got an enormous market potential. Similarly, Japan is a very interesting country, very high standard of living. They buy a lot of imported products, of quality products. High quality products will go down there, and they're not as price sensitive as some other markets. But if you're looking at more bulk products that you're selling, then find the market that best suits those, because the opportunities will be there in some markets. So, for instance, I just said in the Gulf, in the Muslim countries, whiskey and alcohol might not be so popular. But very tasty cordial drinks and even water go down very well. Mm-hmm. So the UK exports a lot of water, believe it or not, bottled water. And yes, it gets branded, and, you know, but we all buy branded water drinks and sparkling water here anyway. But cordials go down very well in the Gulf, because if they're not drinking alcohol, they still want something tasty. And there are lots of opportunities in food there. And for instance, I mentioned earlier, the Lulu supermarket, one of the reasons why they have a buying office in the UK is because they have a British event every month or two, at which they will feature products from Britain. They do the same from other countries as well, of course. So you've got a lot of opportunities throughout the world. We were selling premium products into what was thought of as poor countries, because even in those poor countries, there was an element of a wealthier market with disposable income who want something different. It always amuses me in this country, one of the things that's paid at a premium is things like olive oil. We don't produce olive oil in this country, so we buy Greek olive oil or Italian olive oil, and you pay more for premium olive oil. So we're operating where that's purely imported. Every country operates in the same way. You know, every country wants these things that they can't necessarily get from their home market, or they want them at a quality that they don't normally perceive from the home market. So depending on what sector of the market you're in, you can do your research and find opportunities throughout the world.
Well, I think that's a very inspiring and positive point on which we can end. So thanks very much for joining me today, Tony. I've learned a lot. That's been a great chat.
It's been a pleasure.